This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease. And the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
Hello, and welcome to Slate's Audio Book Club. I'm Megan O'Rourke, a culture critic for Slate, and joining me today are Michael Agger, a Slate editor and writer. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
And Troy Patterson, Slate's TV critic, among other things.
Hey, Troy. Megan.
Today, we are discussing a book I'm really excited to talk about, Tom McCarthy's Remainder. It is, what can we say about Remainder? I'm flipping the pages here. It's the story of a man who has suffered an accident and becomes preoccupied. Well, he suffers an accident. He is granted a settlement, a very large settlement. And he's preoccupied for a while with that word settlement. And
yeah.
Sort of enunciates the T in it. Of £8.5 million. Is this correct?
Yeah, it's Otto e Mezzo in Fellini's Italian.
Mm. Wonderful. And becomes preoccupied, debates what he's going to do with this money, and becomes preoccupied with creating reenactments, or rather enactments that become reenactments. And they're, what can we say about these enactments and reenactments? They're designed to elicit a feeling that he gets every now and then, this kind of tingling feeling. It starts actually when he first thinks about the moment before the accident that he had. He remembers the feeling of the wind around him, and a kind of buzzing, tingling feeling comes over him. And then he experiences another version of this, looking at the crack in a bathroom at a friend's party or an acquaintance's party.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess one thing we should mention about the accident is that the protagonist, I guess he's never really named, he loses the ability to kind of do the most basic motions of life. So he talks about having to sort of relearn how to walk or how to open the door. And so, you know, part of the spur of the reenactments is to try to do things sort of naturally again. And the crack in the wall that you're referring to, you know, that eventually becomes a crack that's contained within this sort of vast apartment house structure that, you know, the narrator feels that if he can recreate this space with all the money that he now has, you know, he might be able to move. And here I'm going to mention the key word of this entire discussion. He might be able to move authentically.
Yes.
in this space without kind of too much pre-thought and self-consciousness. And he could just kind of sort of be in the moment. And I think that sort of being in the moment seems to be connected to the spine tingling. Is that what you guys picked up in the book?
Yes. Go ahead, Troy.
Well, I think he sort of falls into the crack, doesn't he? and, well, I think the important thing to me about that sort of first moment where he has this sort of spasm of a vision of wanting to sort of recreate this sort of moment in a dream, or is it a dream, or is it just sort of a deja vu sense? He's seen this crack before, and he falls into it, and it opens up this whole vision of his living in an apartment, and there's such a view across the way, and there's a pianist downstairs making errors as he plays Rachmaninoff, and a lady making liver.
Mm-hmm.
So one way of thinking about things is that this whole bizarre scenario is a quest for sort of a quest to achieve some kind of authenticity or to get to something that he's lost.
Yeah. I think that. I'm sorry. I feel like I just cut you off.
No, not at all. I was just trying to decide if it would be sort of fruitful to talk about Freud's idea of what déjà vu was, which is that it's these things are triggered by unconscious fantasies, right? And so on Sunday night when I was in the kitchen making lentil beans and had this sharp sense of deja vu, it wasn't about sort of the lentil beans. It was about sort of having slipped into some sort of emotional state or not quite remembered something that who knows, that the smell evoked.
I think both the Freud model and then there's the biological model that I've heard that it's one part of your brain catching up with the other part of your brain, that's what deja vu is. You know, there's this – both of those seem useful to me in thinking about this book and its preoccupations. And Michael, I'm glad you brought up authenticity because that absolutely seems like one of the preeminent preoccupations of the book. I mean, it seems to me that the book is in many ways throughout struggling with the question of sort of origins too, right? And there is a way of preoccupation with going backward, as you're saying, like looking back for that moment. And I think maybe reading just the very first paragraph would be useful here. On page 3, he says, "About the accident itself, I can say very little, almost nothing. It involved something falling from the sky, technology, parts, bits. That's it, really, all I can divulge. Not much, I know." And That paragraph becomes sort of an aesthetic model for the rest of the book and for what McCarthy seems to be up to, which is this way of kind of deconstructing. Zadie Smith called it constructive deconstruction in her article about this book and Joseph O'Neill's Netherland in the New York Review of Books, that part of McCarthy's project is this avant-garde project to get away from what Zadie Smith was calling the lyric realism of the novel and to draw attention to the act of construction that is writing in of itself. So there's that whole level. And then on the level of plot, there's this obsession, as you said, Michael, with getting back to the natural. This is the kind of book, it strikes me, that could seem very kind of theoretical and theorized and brainy. You know, it's trying to be a kind of new novel in the sense of Alain Robbe-Grillet and others. But I found it deeply enjoyable to read. And actually, one of the first questions I wanted to ask is just, did you enjoy this novel?
I did. It's very smooth. There's not an ounce of fat on it. And it has a daydream-like quality that fits perfectly with the character's situation. He's sort of brain damaged, and he's kind of interested in this eerie project. It's also a book that's more patterned, I think, than plotted. The Alain Robbe-Grillet was an apt reference. And in that patterning, it's there's a kind of level of physical detail in the way that he traces things that works well as sort of a reflection of the character's attempt to recover himself to a degree, to learn how to move again and pick up a carrot and to rework the circuitry of his head. You know, one thing I would say about this novel as sort of an experience or an experiment in deconstruction is I would alert anyone who hasn't read it not to be scared off by that by that judgment. It's not sort of deconstructivist in the kind of showy way that John Barth or William Gaddis or somebody like that shows you the sort of the gears and the mechanics. Well, I mean, it starts and it ends, and you are aware that what is opening up is a pure story. There's an important moment early on where we sort of very elegantly get in touch with the narrator's unreliability when he begins to tell us a story about picking up a homeless guy off the street and taking him out to lunch or a meal. When they go to a meal and the sort of scene sort of fragments and crumbles and breaks into shards. And that, I think, was a nice sort of effective way of kind of letting you sink into the irreality of what follows.
Yeah, I would, second that non-warning, I guess. I mean, to me, like, the book sort of had a very much like a memento-like propulsion to it, you know, the sort of guy, you know, obsessed with some vague event in the past and sort of, you know, desperately rearranging his world to kind of, you know, get back at something. And so it's almost there's a kind of detective, you know, story quality, to the story that carried me through. And then, you know, not to be too much of a spoiler, but, you know, it has, you know, a bank robbery or you know, it very much goes into the realm of the real and the kind of straight ahead, old fashioned narrative excitement. What did you think of the book, Megha?
I love this book. Yeah. I think it's just I think it's brilliant and funny and absurd and serious and invigorating and all of those things at the same time and really unexpected. I feel like it was just different from anything I had read in a while and yet not at the same time. And someone had given it to me who said, oh, this book is just, you know, who said that this book is utterly unlike anything you will have read in a while. And with that approach to it, I thought, well, this book isn't that unlike anything I've read, right? but I think that what McCarthy is trying to do is to draw attention to and deconstruct, as I said, the sort of the kinds of stories we tell ourselves about the world, and to kind of it's an anti-romantic novel in a sense, right? It's not about kind of, even though it's preoccupied with authenticity, it's not, doesn't ultimately get us to a place where the narrator kind of achieves that authenticity. There's a propulsion where you feel from the beginning he keeps having the tingling. He has these moments. I loved the Freud deja vu and the sort of idea that it's a fantasy that you're trying to enter, because I think that is what this whole novel is about. There's a sort of fantasy that we're trying to enter, which is this feeling of wholeness, right? This feeling of authenticity, this feeling of naturalness, remembering what it was like to walk. There's a great moment after he's told us that he had to relearn how to walk, and he talks about you have to reroute all the signals in your brain and learn how to mimic each movement. And he says, everything I do now is secondhand. And he's watching Mean Streets with his friend, and he looks at Robert De Niro, and he's like, Robert De Niro is flaccid. And as opposed to plastic, which is rigid, right? And there's a kind of a naturalness to De Niro's movement. And that's what he's looking for, right, is that sense of naturalness. And it seems to me that that's what the whole novel is doing. You know, on the meta level, that's what the novel is kind of talking about too, right, that we're in this belated moment where we're looking for a kind of naturalness, a non-self-conscious way of writing, telling stories, and inhabiting that romantic vision. But we can't, or he can't. That's what I sort of took away. On the meta level.
Yeah. Let me read a bit and sort of
ground my abstractions here.
To flip back to the moment when he's walking out of Mean Streets, he writes, "The other thing that struck me as we watched the film was how perfect De Niro was. Every movie made, each gesture was perfect, seamless, whether it was lighting up a cigarette or opening a fridge door or just walking down the street. He seemed to execute the action perfectly, to live it, to merge with it until he was it, and it was him, and there was nothing in between." I commented on this to Greg as we walked back to mine. I hadn't noticed that.
I hadn't noticed it either, actually.
I wonder if that's deliberate.
Yeah, it seems a little like a typo almost. Should be my apartment or something.
Continuing later in this conversation, he says, he's relaxed, malleable. He flows into his movements, even the most basic ones, opening fridge doors, lighting cigarettes. He doesn't have to think about them or understand them first. He doesn't have to think about them because he and they are one, perfect, real. My movements are all fake, secondhand. And we're going to juxtapose that with sort of a passage 2 pages later where he's at Heathrow Airport and watching people disembark from planes. Some of the arriving passengers scanned the waiting faces for relatives, but most weren't being met. These ones came out carrying some kind of regard to show to the assembled crowd, some facial disposition they'd struck up just before the door slid open for them. They might be trying to look hurried, as though they were urgently needed because they were very important and their business couldn't run without them. Or they might look carefree, innocent, and happy, as though unaware that 50 or 60 pairs of eyes were focused on them, just on them, if only for 2 seconds. Which, of course, they weren't. Unaware, I mean. How could you be? Those 2 passages go towards McCarthy's skill at making the strange familiar and the familiar strange, which again feels all the more easy and natural because it sort of comports with the narrator's situation. For another, it reminds me of that line that sort of actors fall back on, which is that people performing on stage or in a movie are sort of being themselves, and it is we in real life who are the actors.
Yeah. It's also interesting because I think that one of the things I wanted to talk about was it seems that this narrator on one level becomes a stand-in for us, right? This accident allows him to become obsessed with the kinds of thoughts that perhaps we've all had and we recognize, right? That feeling of being secondhand, the feeling of the crack feeling, which you basically just had yourself, Troy, right? We have these feelings, and the device of the accident and this derangement to his brain and having to relearn everything allows McCarthy very, very naturally, very fluidly, and I think just kind of beautifully to let that become the main preoccupation of the book. As you said, Troy, it's not really plotted so much as patterned. And this is a character who's obsessed with finding patterns and relearning patterns. But one of the questions I had about the book is he believes, as he says here in this passage you just read, that no one can be unaware, right? That everyone is in this predicament to some degree. Well, there's actually a paradox there because on the one hand, De Niro isn't, right? But then as he looks around the world, he's always finding kind of flaws in the patterns, and it seems like everyone else is part of that flaw too. Does that make sense? I mean, maybe I should go back and say that differently.
Yeah, but, I mean, yeah, that's a good, like, what could we identify as, like, the moments where, you know, authenticity kind of leaks into this narrative? I mean, is it like when the black guy gets gunned down on his motorcycle? I mean, on his bicycle? I mean, that seems to be sort of when he reenacts that particular scenario, that's when he feels like, you know, he's entered, I don't know, you know, some moment of non-self-consciousness for him. Did you find them?
I think also it's that the moments of authenticity are matters of chance. Even the initial sort of accident that motivates the story is a case of his being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Just now when you mentioned that, I thought of one of the incidents that he has reenacted involved this weird thing with his car where the wiper fluid kind of explodes through the dashboard and onto his pants. I think that that's the real moment. I think that, you know, in life are the moments that we're most ourselves are.
Yeah, no, that's
in life,
yeah.
In life, perhaps maybe the moments when we're most ourselves are those when we are caught off guard.
And that moment is really important because right before that, the guy has poured in the wiper fluid and it seems to have disappeared. It seems almost like a kind of Christ disappearing from the, right? It's like becomes a symbol for a transubstantiation,
yeah.
Right? It disappears and he thinks this is actually, you know, I don't think he uses the word magical. I can't find the passage here. But there's this kind of sense of disbelief. Wait, something has actually – it's one of the preoccupations that the protagonist has is this question of matter, right? He says in the end of the first chapter that his problem, his undoing was matter, right? This messy, irksome matter that had no respect for millions, that didn't know its place. And that's actually what happens, right? The windshield wiper fluid seems to disappear and then it actually – and he's all – kind of a flutter with this sense of, oh, there's something has happened. And then, boom, it spills out right all over him. And it is this moment of authenticity. But let's talk about the reenactments a little bit. What are these reenactments and how are they functioning?
I was wondering if you guys, like me, I eventually got extremely annoyed by the reenactments. I just felt like, you know, they kept and I think that was deliberate on McCarthy's part. It's just like he kept everything that happened to kind of, you know, he's like, oh, well, let's reenact that. You know, it's kind of just builds and builds and builds and builds. And so I don't know. I just wanted to know if you guys felt like the repetition was just a little, how did that work for you? And I'm also curious, like we haven't talked about his kind of enabler throughout all of this. This guy, you know, he kind of hooks up with this sort of high-end celebrity services, take care of everything firm.
A facilitator,
thank you.
Nazrul Ram Vyas. I don't know how I would say
this. Yeah, and so Naz's project is to kind of, you know, make all the enactments happen. And he, you know, so he's kind of approaching the world from a different perspective as our protagonist. You know, he's trying to kind of, you know, engineer it, you know, down to the last detail. So, sorry, I'll just try to hopefully expand upon your question and, you know, just kind of say, yeah, throw it back over to Troy, you know, and sort of, were you annoyed by the reenactments and what do you think of the facilitator?
Maybe perhaps around page 160 or so, I sort of sped my pace of reading through these reenactments. I don't think the book would be quite as successful without them, however. They're sort of essential to establishing a certain pace and a tone. Although I suppose it is true that you don't get, as in a Rob Grier novel, the sort of sense that things are developing.
It wasn't actually the reenactments. I was fascinated by the reenactments. Mm-hmm. I felt like I could have read about the reenactments forever. In fact, the more particular the reenactment, the more interested I was. I was a little bit surprised that the novel went in the direction of making the reenactments larger and more dramatic and more cinematic, right? More like you mentioned a bank robbery. Many very dramatic things happen at the end of this book, and I guess one question we have is, should we discuss them?
Yeah, we have to do the spoiler because it's so important to the book.
So we should mention that there's a spoiler. So here comes spoilers. But yeah, I mean, the reenactments go from being these kind of obsessive preoccupations with reenacting a crack, right, in the wall and how that looked. That stuff I was fascinated with, to bank robbery and ultimately murder and goes up. I don't know who wants to describe the reenactments. I got impatient with that element of it because I thought, really, do we have to go here? Do we have to go to the kind of explosive, over the top? And then, of course, I think it's inevitable that he did. I mean, that's a really important part of the novel, that McCarthy makes the choices to go with the reenactments where he goes, and that part of the novel started to seem. Makes you circle back to this whole question of the settlement and what happens, and the question posed by what happens when someone is granted extraordinary power through being given a huge sum of money almost randomly and accidentally, right? Which is, the money is the precipitating factor for everything that happens here.
The money sort of, kind of, you know, his life already has this artificiality because he's sort of relearning everything, and then, you know, it kind of, the money is just like it's almost like a joke. It just removes any sort of motive to get a job. You know, there's no sort of foundation for this guy anymore. You know, he's out there floating. But, you know, I think the thing about the bank robbery that we should mention, and this is definitely a spoiler, so is that, you know, the protagonist and Nas set up this plan to reenact a bank robbery, and then they eventually decide to take it to the next level, which is that they will know that the bank robbery is real, but the reenactors will not. So they're going to rob a real bank with reenactors.
Who think it's just like those that they have done before.
And there's this wonderful scene in the car, when they're waiting in the car outside the bank. I wonder if we should read that.
I think we could also mention that the narrative starts to fragment there, and his sense of, you know, one of the questions the book raises is the question of reality. We might say his grasp of reality starts to really disintegrate there, but that raises all sorts of questions about, well, what was the reality that we were experiencing earlier in the book, and what was his reality, and what's our relationship to the reality being created by his narration, right?
Right.
But, Michael.
Well, okay. Yes, that's...
I think it would be in keeping with the sort of the spirit of the book if, instead of editing out what just happened,
we just left it in. Yeah. Should we reenact it? No. We could just start over.
Let me just read this passage because I like this part. And I think, you know, we've been talking about McCarthy abstractly, but especially in this book, and I think in the next one, if we get to it, see, you know, his talent for description is this big strength, I think. But anyway, so they're waiting in the cars.
What page we're on?
Oh, on page 282. To start then from the moment, the long stretched-out moment during which we waited, set in our positions for it to begin, to start again. We sat, seven of us, six robber reenactors and two drivers in two cars, one parked on each side of the street outside the bank. We sat in silence waiting. The other reenactors in my car looked through the windows, fascinated, watching shoppers, businessmen, mothers with pushchairs, and traffic wardens walking up and down the pavement, entering and leaving shops, crossing the road, milling around at bus stops. They watched them intently, looking for cracks in their personas, inconsistencies in their dress, the way they moved and so on, that might show them up as the reenactors they'd been told they were. Their eyes follow these people round corners, trying to spot the reenactment zone's edge. They've been told that the zone would be wide and not demarcated as clearly as the shooting ones had been, that its edges would be blurred, buffered by side and back streets as they merged gradually, almost imperceptibly with real space. They've been told this, but they still looked for some kind of boundary. So I just thought that was very cool, this kind of, You know that.
Can I just read the next sentence
too?
Because then he goes on to say, I watched, too, with the same fascination. I stared amazed at the passers-by, their postures, their joints articulation as they moved. They were all doing it just right, standing, moving, everything, and this without even knowing they were doing it, which seems like kind of the capstone to that great, great passage you just read.
So, yeah, should we return to kind of your question, which is like, you know, the level of the narrative construction of the book itself and, you know, our trust in it. And I mean, you know, I mean, McCarthy is playing on that level too, because there is this kind of David Lynchian character that appears, this short counselor, you know, who we're not really sure if he's real or not. And he seems to be a projection of the protagonist's imagination. So, you know, things start falling apart.
Yeah, he's also sort of the sort of the first serious voice of sort of skepticism in the right. It's like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
As the character is beginning to make these things happen, and as the facilitator is facilitating, there are these interior decorators who storm out because they don't want to be told to create this imagined space exactly. And there are these sort of performers and actors who sort of don't get the idea. But these are mere.
See, I was kind of with the short counselor. I mean, ultimately, like with this book, I'm kind of like, well, you know, what's the takeaway? Like, here's a guy who can't really, you know, process that you can be both, you know, fluid and natural, yet also have moments of, you know, feeling of doubt and self-constructed. You kind of can't live with this paradox that, like, you know, we all kind of make up ourselves as we go along. And I don't know. When I read these books, I'm like, is that a useful road to go on? You know, it's kind of there lies madness if you kind of, you know, obsessively contemplate every action. I mean,
well, I think it's maybe important to note that. So on page 299, the protagonist, the culmination of all this, or what would be the culmination in a different kind of novel, in a strange way, it's almost not quite the culmination here, is he ends up shooting people, right? He ends up becoming, if we're to trust the narration, he ends up murdering people in this whole obsessive pursuit of simulacrums. He ends up actually taking life away. And so let me just read quickly page 299. The numbers are referring to different robber reenactors whom he's hired. And he says, two was as far from me as four had been from him when he, too, had shot him, four, in the bank. He was still moving forward, lumbering toward me. So I shot him. It was half instinctive, a reflex, as I'd first suspected, to tug against the last solid thing there was, which was the trigger, tug against it as though it were a fixed point that the body could be pulled back up from. But I'd be lying if I said it was only that that made me pull the trigger and shoot, too. I did it because I wanted to. Seeing him standing there in Four's position as I stood in his, replaying in first my mind and then my body his slow fall, I'd felt the same compulsion to shoot him as I'd felt outside Victoria Station that day to ask passers-by for change. Essentially, it was the movements, the positions, and the tingling that made me do it, nothing more. So we come to this moment that is can't be reenacted, right, in some sense.
Hopefully.
because that single person is no longer there. And were you expecting this trajectory for the book? What did you make of reaching murder, I suppose?
I mean, it makes as much sense for it to go as anywhere else.
Yeah.
Because the guy's affect is so flat, there's only sort of so much emotional development that's going to happen. And because of his isolation, you know, there's not going to be any sort of interpersonal drama by the same token.
Not a love story.
Yeah. and I do like a good heist. I do like a good heist. And so it works with a book that is patterned, and, you know, the book is about plans, and the fun of a heist narrative is in the sort of the planning and watching the sort of the execution. It's sort of I don't know. I like the sort of process-oriented nature of it. And then a violent conclusion, although it's I see Michael's point that it's a bit abrupt.
Yeah, he's so without – you know, he's so detached. And, you know, I read – when the murder goes down in the airplane hang – or, you know, the airport, wherever it happens, you know, that was sort of – I felt like McCarthy was kind of, you know, passing judgment on this character. Like, you know, like we've been in the mind of a psychopath. You know, I actually kind of liked it. I thought like, oh, well – you know, like, oh, he's kind of, like, involved in these, like, cool reenactment projects. It feels very, like, kind of pomo and, like, almost like he's an artist. And then he's, like – but then, like, you know, he kind of gradually edges into kind of a mania, a controlling mania. And then – and this kind of, you know, having it, you know, spin out into actual death. And you know, the death isn't really important, that important. It's, like, the creepy thing he does where he's kind of, like – he's, like, sticks his fingers in the wound. And it's, like, oh, it's spongy and, you know, kind of is obsessed with, like, the matter of death. You know, here, like, this incontrovertible fact that, you know, he's produced this effect in the world.
And had been a Don DeLillo novel and then it became American Psycho? That's not quite right, but
yeah. No,
well, there is like yeah. it's amoral, right? Mm-hmm. We're not in a moral universe. It's sort of like an Ambien universe. It's like that sleepwalking state you feel. Have you ever like woken up on Ambien and realized that you sort of have no? I don't know. It seems like it's a world without morals, and that's kind of the world.
Remind me not to say hello to you in the morning.
I mean, there's like no affect. I mean, there's no affect. And nothing exciting happened to me. Trust me. I like reorganized some piles of books. But I just remember when I woke up, I was like, oh, that was like a feeling of living in a world without affect somehow. Yeah. And that seems a little bit like kind of in like curiously at once curious and incurious, right, about the world, like deeply curious about matter and the objectivity of things. And, you know, it has literary precedence, I think, probably in The Stranger or in, you know, or even Raskolnikov in some ways, right? But it's different. You're making a face at me, Troy.
No. It's a face of comprehension and understanding. It also reminded me of Despair, of Nabokov's mm-hmm. Despair, mm-hmm. In which, you know, a narrator very precisely leads us into weird terrain.
Yeah. I've never read Despair, but now I'm going. Now I want to read like a whole series.
Check it out. And in as much as it's about doubles, that it makes a good pair with this book. Also, in the course of this discussion, I was reminded of Charlie Kaufman's Schenectady, New York. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm.
It's a movie that's more interesting than it is good. It stars.
Schenectady, the Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did I mispronounce it? Schenectady?
I thought you said Schenectady.
Isn't that a city in New York?
No.
Well, can you like take the train there or something? Like,
go ahead.
No, I was just. It's about Philip Seymour Hoffman plays this theater director who gets a grant and then sort of starts creating this sort of installation piece where he's people are acting in a world. And it keeps building out sort of fractally. And so he's then needs to duplicate the sort of process of himself working on it. So he hires actors to like play himself and his assistant.
I love that movie. Yeah. And it reminded me, I thought of that too, reading this, because you become very confused about what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
Watching. This may be the moment to note, in fact, that Remainder, I think, was optioned as a movie in Britain. I mean, you were talking earlier, Michael, about kind of escalating the bank robbery heist. Mm-hmm. But also to note that Tom McCarthy, you know, sort of has identified in a self-conscious way, right, as an avant-garde artist, as part of this. He was the general secretary of something called the International Necronautical Society, or the INS, which is a semi-fictitious avant-garde network. And this book was first published or sort of disseminated almost as an art project, right, through galleries and otherwise, rather than through what we might call traditional mainstream publishing. It was later picked up, I think years later, picked up by Vintage here and published as a book. And so that's sort of interesting to think about, too, is the modes of transmission of this text, as it were, and how that affects – what does that affect how you think about the book at all? I mean, for me, I guess because I had received it as a book, I just read it as a book and then later discovered that it had been conceptualized rather differently. But I don't know where I'm going with this.
Yeah, I agree. Like, yeah, it's like if you had been like slipped this book in an art gallery, you know, I think framed in that way, you know, the kind of – you might be more attuned to kind of like the, you know, the mind-blowing qualities of it, well, I guess, you know, whereas like as opposed to just kind of the – the cold, hard, is this a good story?
Well, and I guess, yeah. And the, what seems to be this kind of implicit, what, you know, you, if, as a social conservative, I suppose you could read this book and detect it, find in it or create for oneself a critique of kind of the culture of, you know, endless reproduction of things, right? Television and so on and so forth. Like there's all this sort of simulacra, you know, reproductions, reenactments that leads the main character to become dissociated from reality and kill somebody. But of course, that's not actually what happens. It doesn't actually lead him to do it, right? The accident has already happened. There's a, some profound disconnect. So there's not a, necessarily narrative consequence to the reenactments or anything. But instead, I think all of the reenactments and all of the what the narrator, the protagonist is trying to do is to hold in mind the simultaneity of events, right? The ways in which he's connected to other things in the world. And early on, before he starts to use his money to do the reenactments, he is visited by this girl, Catherine. This is the aborted love story in the book, right? The novel that might have been, where this is different. She comes. They've had this sort of sexual tension for months, and he's been fantasizing about what might happen when she arrives. And instead, he just becomes annoyed with her. But she's a kind of do-gooder who has worked in Africa, and she says, you should create a fund that would basically, you know, help people. And he says, well, how would I see it? Something to that effect. Yeah. And he wants to see it. And she said, well, why does it matter if you can see it? And he says he can't explain it to her, but he has this feeling, right, that he would have to be able to see what it was doing. And there's a lot of moments like that where he's trying to hold in mind grids and networks. And in that sense, the book seemed also to be.
That's a good point. That drives his investment strategy,
right,
too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like he needs to kind of see and contemplate it. And so, yeah, sort of a. He's kind of a locavore of the mind, I guess, or
trying to deal with the kind of it's almost like the epistemological question of like we know that there are things that we can't see in the world. You know, we know that Africa exists. We know that these other things are happening. We know this money is being wired to us. But where does it come from and where does it go? And even the accident is like that too, right? Like where does the accident come from? It's falling stuff. What fell? Why did it fall? Is someone to blame? There's a settlement. But the story is remarkably uninterested in any of that, right? That's just a beginning point.
Right. I don't know. There's a period early on when he's sort of sorting out what he's going to do with all this money. And so he kind of thinks about philanthropy but decides that there are no causes that he's especially interested in. A friend of his wants him to spend it all on drugs and hookers. You know, this idea that money is important because of the way it makes you feel in spending it and what you spend it on. And I think he's spending it kind of trying to feel something, right? And is it kind of moments of freedom from self-consciousness? Am I on sort of the right path?
I think it is, yeah. Well, maybe should we take the kind of leap into materiality with the next book? The kind of, you know, we leave the disembodied self-consciousness of remainder or
we could do that.
We only
have a couple more minutes, so we're not going to be able to go too much into C, but we should. But maybe we should just talk about or read the very last paragraph of Remainder and talk about that, because he does actually feel happy at the end of this book. Does someone want to read the last paragraph?
I'll read the last paragraph. I looked out of the window again. I felt really happy. We passed through a small cloud. The cloud, seen from inside like this, was gritty, like spilled earth or dust flakes in a stairwell. Eventually the sun would set forever, burn out, pop, extinguish, and the universe would run down like a Fisher-Price toy whose spring is unwound to its very end. Then there'd be no more music, no more loops. Or maybe, before that, we'd just run out of fuel. For now, though, the clouds tilted and the weightlessness set in once more as we banked, turning, heading back again. I think he steals a move from the end of The Great Gatsby in that.
The boat's beating.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Which is a good move to steal.
It's a good move to steal. It's interesting because Gatsby is such a different novel. So we do arrive at this kind of moment of happiness and weightlessness, and that does seem to be, as you were saying, Troy, a kind of freedom.
But he's not being born backwards into the past. He's trapped in this kind of circuit that's pleasurable to him. Like that. Please explain the end to me, because it's just a little bit of a setup. You know, he's pointing a gun at the pilot who's been commanded to go back to return the plane back to the hangar or whatever. But instead, he's commanded the pilot to go back and forth on this kind of. So what was your reading of the end, Megan?
Well, I think that what the kind of the romantic hero, the humanist hero of the novel, if we were reading a different book, right? I keep setting this up against a kind of a supposed other kind of novel we might be reading, I guess partly because of having read Zadie Smith's piece, that character would feel, or in a movie, right, that character would feel despair and they're trapped and you know, Dog Day Afternoon, that sense of like, oh, this there's sort of kind of tragedy and the anti-hero is being caught and we don't want them to be caught, or just that sense of having to fend it off. But for him, he doesn't feel that. He just gets absorbed almost like a child or a drugged, I guess that's why I brought up the Ambien, a drugged person in the sensation. There's a kind of way in which it's fascinating because on one hand, he's always trying to live in some other moment. And yet a lot of the time, this character lives in the present, in the sensation of the present in a way that people find very difficult, I think. And so I thought that that was part of what was happening here, was that we as readers are becoming worried for him. What's going to happen? And rather than getting what was going to happen, we get stuck in this moment, in this, as you so I think eloquently put it, Michael, this kind of circuit, this loop that's pleasurable to him, and we're that end that we expect is we don't get, and so we don't know literally what happens, but this is what is happening.
Well, this is his goal, is to achieve
that
loop,
yes.
And sort of infinitely extend the present, which is why it's so disconcerting. There's a bit the foreshadowing of this early on is when he's forgotten something and he needs to keep returning home and talks about turning this figure eight pattern with its sort of infinite loop.
Yes, which we see at the beginning. Well, we are about to be out of time. So, Michael, I think you want to talk about C, so we should just jump forward for a moment. Do you want to just talk for a second about that book? Because it's very different in some ways from this book.
Well, yeah. Well, it just yeah. It's you
did
know.
Did
you we're
like
talking,
it? Would you recommend it? I guess we could.
Yeah,
say those
it's fascinating. So I read C first, and then I jumped back into Remainder, and you wouldn't think they were written by the same author almost. I mean, so you know, C is this kind of drops you into like a Mason and Dixon Pynchon like setting. You know, there's kind of these lots of antiquated nouns, and we're dealing with experiments and telegraphy, I guess would be the word. the guy who kind of dropped this sort of avant-garde art gallery type experimental fiction kind of returns with a very kind of dense materialist historical novel, but that with a kind of detached narrator, right? I mean, so I guess that's the connection between the two. But, I thought C has some kind of powerful stuff in it. I know, reactions have been mixed, but I really thought, the war, I thought it was a great war novel, or the war episodes were really, really good. To kind of just keep rambling on here, he was, this is World War I, not World War II, the main character, this guy, Serge, is it Carifax, I believe, is... so it's kind of the very when airplanes are kind of first introduced into the battlefield and just kind of these lots of great details. For example, airplanes didn't really shoot at each other. It's kind of they were originally just for observation. You kind of fly by and wave at your enemy. It's this kind of McCarthy has these kind of great descriptions of what it's like to be under bombardment and has kind of a penchant like lyricism, I think, sort of wonderful to sort of reread paragraphs. But, unlike, I guess, Remainder, I had a little trouble figuring out what it all added up to. But what were your guys' impressions of C?
I couldn't finish it. it was like cement, and the cement has been very nicely laid. It shares with Remainder that kind of attention to detail in the in the opening chapters. We're getting these very precise descriptions of like landscape architecture and sort of what happens in dealing with mulberry bushes and silk. But I think and perhaps it's attributable to the kind of adoption of this period voice, is that it feels sort of overwritten and it's sort of like a little bit clinical, a little bit of like it's proceeding at a murmur, as opposed to the kind of clean, spruce sentences of Remainder.
Yes, Remainder is clipped and C is sort of an overgrown, you know, folly a little, right?
Right.
But which has its true pleasures. I mean, one thing I just want to say is I love McCarthy's sense of humor. There's a lot of wit in both books, and it's sort of subtle and funny, but it's present. And often one doesn't find humor in the avant-garde, right? Certain kinds of avant-garde works.
I don't know. Those Aleppo guys crack me up.
Okay.
No?
Sometimes.
Read Harry Matthews.
Maybe that's not true. Oh, no, Harry Matthews. Okay, I take it back. I take it totally back. Maybe I've just been reading. Maybe, what is it? All right, I take that back utterly. Oh, Harry Matthews is great. Harry Matthews is very funny, too. All right, well, we actually need to come to a close. And any last comments? Thoughts? Reenact.
I'm going to leave thinking about what, if anything, Remainder has to say about rereading. That is all.
Yes, I will gratefully reenact my rereading of Remainder with your thoughts.
Well, this is, it's like
we should do
Toni Morrison's idea. You can't read a book, you can only reread it. And so what does kind of the reengagement of, you know, so when you read a book for the second time, what are you doing? Are you reenacting your experience, or is there this kind of like folly that you're going to feel precisely what you felt the sort of the first time? I mean, I suppose I'm talking about reading for pleasure as opposed to studying something, but
I think it is like deja vu, right? It's like you get these glimpses of what you were doing and where you were when you read before, but you're actually in a different place and you're sort of trying. It's a fascinating question, because are you trying to recapture or are you re-experiencing? There's a triangulation with the old self, the book, and the new self, too.
Well put.
Well, I don't know about that. But thank you all for joining us. Thank you, too, for joining me today for our discussion of Remainder. Our next audiobook club will be a reenactment of this discussion. We will be discussing Remainder, rereading Remainder.
Excellent.
Actually, we should. I wish we were. Probably we will not be doing that. But join us next time for our next book, To Be Determined. And for Slate.com, I'm Megan O'Rourke.